College graduation is just around the corner. What money moves should new graduates consider? How about the high school graduates and their parents who are saving to attend college? How about the 20 and 30-somethings who might be considering buying their first home? We'll cover all these topics and more in a special Millennials edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our regular financial expert, Kevin McKinley, has the day off, but we have a personal finance expert who focuses on 20 and 30-year-olds. If you have a personal finance question of any kind, we welcome it at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Sophia Berra, a nationally recognized certified financial planner in Minneapolis. Her focus is on financial education and financial planning for people in their 20s and 30s. Her website is genyplanning.com. Good morning. Thanks very much for being with us again.
Thank you so much for having me back. I'm excited to be here.
Well, let's talk about some advice for new college grads with college graduation just around the corner. What general advice do you have for them as they venture into the real world?
Sure. So the first place I start is stay out or get out of credit card debt. So a lot of the time, students have started to accumulate a little bit of credit card debt while in college, and I think that I think the average right now is around $2,000. And so just making sure to nip that in the bud right away and get rid of that credit card debt. And if you're not in credit card debt, stay out of that. I also think it's a great time to start building emergency savings now while your student loans are in deferment. So usually there's about a six-month, or I should say a grace period. There's about a six-month grace period before students have to start paying back their student loans. So this is a great time to really boost that emergency savings. And then figure out a plan for your student loans, which repayment plan you want to do. Get some guidance around that. Talk to the financial aid counselor and really see what your options are. There's a lot more public loan programs available right now. So pay as you earn, income-based repayment. There's also the standard 10-year repayment if you don't have a lot of student loans, which is great because you'll pay off your student loans faster than some of these, you know, 20, 25-year programs. And don't forget to start sign up for your 401k and start saving for retirement with that first job.
Well, I wanted to follow up a little bit on the credit card debt, stay out or get out. Let's say someone has the average $2,000 debt right now. How do you get out of that debt?
So I think a great way to do that is what I like to call starting a side hustle. So let's say you graduate from college, you get that full-time job. But let's say in college you waited tables or worked part-time tutoring, those types of things. Those jobs make great side hustle jobs. So a way that you can bring in a few extra $1,000 a year, a couple hundred dollars a month, that you can direct that money towards your financial goals. So keep working that part-time job for college or start tutoring, dog walking, freelancing. You know, maybe you build websites and are good at web design. Those types of things all make great side hustles, and that's a great way to be able to get rid of that credit card debt really quickly and then boost that emergency savings as well.
You wrote a blog entry about side hustles, and I have to admit I'm really out of it. I had not heard of a side hustle before. It's just taking on just some part-time gig.
Exactly, and I think it's a great way to accelerate wealth building. So a lot of times people have created a budget and they can maybe save, maybe they have an extra, you know, $200 a month going towards their debt and maybe an extra $100 a month going towards savings. But if they are able to get another side gig where they could bring in $500 a month, think about how quickly they'd be able to reach those goals even faster.
Interesting. So where does one begin if they think they need a side hustle?
Sure. I think there's a lot of great websites to help people with those things now. I always say start with your community first. So if there are skills that you have in different areas, really figuring out where you can use those skills. So I think tutoring is a great one. There's also, especially for new grads, because all of that information is fresh, there's also websites you can go on to create, so like tutor.com or WiseAnt. Those are great ways to post a resume online or a little bit about yourself and your expertise, and then people can hire you to tutor them virtually as well. So that's another thing to think about. And then in terms of freelance, there's great websites such as Odesk, Elance.com, Freelancer. Those are good places to, you know, grab your first few gigs and then try to branch out and establish your own website. If you do have expertise in, you know, certain areas, maybe it's WordPress, maybe it's, you know, in web design, maybe it's freelance writing, for example. If you can, you know, create your own website and really market those skills, that's a great way for people to find you and be able to, you know, once you get those first few gigs, build that into some recurring income.
I mean, I was going to say, it's not necessarily getting a part-time job at the fast food restaurant. This is something that it's your own little business.
Exactly. And I think that these skills translate really well into being able to actually create a business out of this. So I've known a lot of people that started freelance writing or freelance mm-hmm. web design, and pretty soon they were earning as much money with their side business as they were with their full-time job, and eventually they were able to quit their full-time job and become entrepreneurs full-time.
Wow, that's kind of neat. How do you stay out of credit card debt?
So staying out of credit card debt, I think, starts with building a budget and figuring out where your money is going every month. So starting by tracking your spending, figuring out what are those fixed monthly costs that you have every month. So rent, health insurance, cell phone bill, those types of things. What are the things that are happening every month? And then how much do you have for those variable expenses? So because things like food, gas, groceries, restaurants, you know, eating out, those types of things vary from month to month, I like to figure out first, how much are those fixed monthly costs? And then how much do we want to put towards those different savings goals or towards debt repayment? And setting those as part of the budget. And then how much do we have for everything else? So maybe you have, you know, $1,000 a month for everything else, the variable expenses, eating out, gas, groceries, those types of things. One of the things that I suggest a lot that my clients do is divide that number by 4 and figure out what is that weekly spending amount that you have. So let's say you make about $3,000 a month. $1,500 goes towards your fixed monthly costs and $500 a month goes towards your savings goals. So retirement, emergency savings, and maybe you're paying $100 extra on your student loan. You're left with about $1,000. And so divide that number by 4, you get $250 a week. And then you can really figure out, okay, I have $250 this week to spend on any variable cost I want, but when it's gone, it's gone. So if I want to go shopping or if I want to eat out, that's fine. You can do those things. But just that's a great way to kind of slowly constrict your budget, but also be able to expand that budget. So if you didn't spend that much money that week and it's every Friday you take out the $250 and it's Thursday and you have $80 left, go out and have a nice dinner. Enjoy yourself because you know that you're going to get that $250 the next day. On the flip side, if it's Wednesday and you have 10 bucks left, figure out how to make that $10 last the next 2 days.
We are talking about those of you who are maybe in your 20s or 30s or recent or soon-to-be college graduates. Do you have a side hustle? Do you have a job, a business on the side to earn some extra cash? If you're not necessarily in your 20s and 30s, do you have some advice for new college graduates? Any financial advice? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We are talking with Sophia Berra, who is a nationally recognized certified financial planner in Minneapolis, who focuses her financial planning for people in their 20s and 30s. We'll talk a little bit later in the program about advice for buying your first home, talk some about advice of saving for a trip, and more, whatever personal finance questions you have, too. I wanted to ask you, Sophia, that new grads tend not to make a whole lot of money right out of college. What tips do you have for living on the cheap, in terms of apartments and food, transportation, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the longer you can stay living like a college student, those first few years out of college, I think the better to really build that solid financial foundation. So I always recommend that people get roommates because the cost of housing and apartments are, that's usually people's biggest expense is their rent. And so if you can live with a few roommates and really keep that expense low, that can be really helpful. Another area is really keeping that kind of the next area that we see that's usually a pretty big expense are those car and vehicle expenses. So sometimes you see people get their first job out of college and go out and buy a new car. And I really warn people against that and try to, discourage that because that $400 a month car payment can really take a big toll on your monthly budget. And that money can go a long way towards building emergency savings and paying off your student loan. So if you do need a car, thinking about getting a used car, taking out a loan credit union that's maybe 3 years instead of a 5 or 6 year loan. And then in terms of other areas where I see people tend to overspend, I think eating out is huge. So the more meals you can cook at home or lunches that you can bring to work, those types of things can really help keep your variable expenses low.
We are having a special Millennials edition of On Your Money. Our regular financial planner, Kevin McKinley, is off today. Very happy to have with us, though, Sophia Berra, who is a certified financial planner in Minneapolis. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page if you have a personal finance question or some personal finance advice for young people. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I need a dollar, dollar.
This is a special Millennials edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Sophia Berra. Kevin McKinley is off today welcoming your questions, especially questions about 20 and 30-somethings and your personal finances. Let's take our first caller, Catherine in Oshkosh. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. I am a recent graduate with a bachelor's, but I'm applying to go on to get my master's and then my PhD, and we have been poor for 5.5 years living on one income, but I know what the reward will be in the end. I'm wondering if your speaker has ever heard of the term the new bachelor's is the master's in terms of, being competitive in the workplace and, I'm just curious.
Yeah, so does she need a master's to make a decent living, Sophia?
Sure. What field are you in? I am in healthcare, public administration.
Okay. And so what's your undergrad in, and then what are you applying for your master's? Why do you feel you need your master's, and kind of what line of work do you want to go into?
Okay. I will get my PhD and teach in a university and continue my research.
Okay.
I graduated with a biology with a healthcare business emphasis and business administration minor, and I will go on to get my master's in public administration.
Okay.
So it's to be in the, obviously. To help, I'm stumbling on my words. In the end, my PhD will be in public health and policy.
Okay. So I think that that's you know, one of those areas. I think a lot more people, like you know, are getting master's degrees, and so now a lot of people that had bachelor's degrees are needing, are wanting to get that master's degree. It sounds like you really want to teach, and at the college level, is that right?
Right.
Okay. And so that's one of those few areas that I think, you know, really requires that PhD, that master's, that additional education to be able to teach at the college level, to be able to continue research, be competitive. But I do think that there's a lot of fields now that don't require that master's degree, and where I think that that a little bit of experience in the workforce can actually really help clarify what it is that people want to study. Sometimes I see people go right from their bachelor's to their master's, and if they had kind of worked for a few years, it might have changed what they got their master's in. It sounds like you have a really clear vision, and you're really excited about, you know, being able to work in education and teach someday and do research and that kind of thing. But I would just encourage you as well to kind of keep doing that research and keep trying to work those side jobs that give you experience and do those internships and things like that in your field, so that the clearer you can get and the more experience and the more connections you can get, I think that those types of internships, jobs, those types of things can really lead to careers that people really enjoy and that can really flourish because they're getting that experience while they're going through school.
Okay, Catherine?
Yeah, sure.
All right. Thanks very much. But what I'm getting from that, Sophia, is that getting a master's right after getting a bachelor's isn't necessarily the best thing for everyone.
Right. I think that sometimes people have this vision of what it's going to be like to be in a certain career, but they've never interviewed anybody in that field before, or they haven't really, you know, done an internship in that field. And so sometimes then they get into this master's program and they realize, oh, wow, now that I'm having these internships or externships, like this field is really a lot different than I thought it could be. So I really encourage people to make those connections. You interview people now that are working in jobs that you think you want to be doing, and asking them questions like, you know, what's your favorite part of your job? And what are some things that surprised you about this position? And tell me a little bit about what your day looks like. And I think those types of things really give people a better idea and a better sense of what it's like to work that job. And also those people might have some great tips about how would you go about getting into this field, or what type of education would you get if you were starting from scratch? And their answers might surprise you. So they might actually recommend that you go get a degree in a little bit different area than you had originally been thinking, or get a master's in a different area, or get some experience in a different area, or take some psychology classes to help with the field that you're in, or take some, you know, additional math courses or whatever that is. And I think that you only learn that through those conversations that you have with people that are already in the field, through internships, and also through through getting that real life experience, seeing if you can get a part-time job working for a company doing something similar to what you want to be doing.
Next we go to Mitch in Bloomington. Hello, Mitch.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question has to deal with college debt. And I know somebody that is paying a little under 9% on their college loan. They're making quite a bit of money. Is there a good program, or what are the chances they can refinance maybe with an institution like a bank at a lower rate? Is that something banks will take on?
Do you know if they're public or private loans?
It's through, yeah, it's a Sallie Mae.
Okay, because Sallie Mae loans, let's see, so some of them used to be private and now some of them are public. So, you know, I just encourage people to pay off those high interest rate loans as quickly as possible. It's, you know, the best thing they can do is talk to the current loan provider. So talk to Sallie Mae and see if there are certain options available. Some people, a lot of times, that people can take out private loans through a bank or a credit union. But, you know, what's tough is that if they're public student loans, they usually have some different programs available in terms of, you know, loan, like forbearance and forgiveness and those types of things. If they're private, a lot of times those are a lot stricter. So one of the things that I would do is just start by contacting the current student loan provider, see if there are any options through them, and then talk to your bank or credit union and see what they recommend and what they suggest. Sometimes it's can be difficult to move those student loans from like from a student loan to like a personal line of credit or a personal loan, and it's sometimes not necessarily the best move. However, for some people who do have those really high interest rate loans, if they are able to cut that interest rate a few percent, that can save them thousands of dollars over the life of the loan. So I would just say start by exploring those different options that you have. If students do have a lot of student loan debt and it is federal, there are a lot of programs out there, such as pay-as-you-earn, income-based repayment. There's, you know, different loan forgiveness programs. The Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program is one of the best ones out there because the balance of your loans is forgiven after 10 years. But that requires you to work in the public sector, either teaching or working at a nonprofit or, you know, doing something along those lines. So just try to do as much research as you can to figure out what are those different options. And they really do vary based on the lender, based on if they're public or private loans, and also the interest rate can really play a big role in deciding what to do.
Thanks for the call, Mitch. If you have a question for Sophia Berra, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Sophia is a certified financial planner in Minneapolis. Her focus is on financial education and financial planning for people in their 20s and 30s. Her website is genyplanning.com. She is with us today because our regular financial planner, Kevin McKinley, has the day off. Kevin will be back next week. Well, our caller brought up Sallie Mae, and that reminded me that a new Sallie Mae study found that parents are saving more for college these days. The average college savings for higher education is now $15,000, up from about $12,000 last year. So what do you think we should do to maximize what we're putting away for college costs, be it parents or how about kids themselves?
So first of all, I think it's really encouraging that parents are saving more for their students' education. The one thing that worries me about that is that there's still a lot of parents that are placing priority on saving for their own child's college before saving for their own retirement. And in that situation, I just like to remind parents that students can take out student loans to pay for college, and there are no loans for retirement. So the best thing that you can do is really to prioritize your own retirement so that you're financially stable and secure, and that can really go a long way. In terms of students saving, I think that so there's a couple different ways that you can go about saving. A lot of parents are starting 529 plans, and I think that those are great vehicles for saving for college, because if that money is used at an accredited college or university, then they don't have to pay taxes on the gains. So I think that that's a great vehicle to use. Check with your current state to see if your state offers some sort of tax break. It would be a state tax break or a tax deduction, or because that can really help to save you current tax dollars, as well as be a great vehicle to save for college. And it really does vary. And if not, if your state doesn't offer a state tax benefit, to look at the fees that are associated with different with different 529 plans. So some are much more expensive and have much higher fees than other ones. And so I think that it's just a, and there's different studies like Morningstar and a few other places do studies each year to come out with like the best 529 plans. So there's a website called savingforcollege.com, and they put out a study every year that has that does some research in terms of kind of what are the most affordable programs to save for. And then for students, I think that, you know, if they can start setting aside some money for their college as well, that can really go a long way, because the more that they can pay, the more they can pay out of pocket, the less they have to take out in student loans. And that can really make a big difference. And then also to remind students that just because your student loan package gave you a certain amount in student loans doesn't mean you have to take out the full amount that was allocated to you. So you can actually choose to take out less student loans if you'd like. And I always try to remind students of that, because a lot of times they just take out the full student loans without really evaluating, well, actually, I already, you know, have some money from my parents, and I have some money from working this summer, so I really only need to take out my subsidized loans and not the subsidized and unsubsidized, for example.
Let's move on to another topic. You had another blog entry about what people need to consider before buying a home. You wrote that the housing market and interest rates are what they are doing is not as important as your own personal economy. What do you mean, and what advice do you have to young people who might be considering getting their first home?
Yeah, so I see a lot of questions that have been coming up lately have been, you know, interest rates are really low. Should I be buying a home right now? Or we're thinking about buying a home because we hear it's a great time to buy. And what I always try to tell people is to really focus on what's going on in your personal economy. And by that, I mean, are there any life changes that are going to happen the next few years, such as a job change, a location change, new additions to the family? Then you might want to hit the pause button on buying, because it's really important to plan on being in that area long term, or at least the next 5 to 10 years. In the past, you know, 5 to 10 years, we've seen a lot of people make purchases of homes and then get a job relocation and have to sell and not have any equity in their home and have really go through a lot of financial hardship because their life was uprooted because of a job change or something like that. And then I also tell people that it's really important to save for that down payment and also to have that emergency savings in place. And those are two different things. So sometimes I see people with their $10,000 emergency savings and they're really excited, but they're going to just use part of, you know, then they save another $10,000 or $20,000 to use as a down payment on the home. But they end up using that full $30,000 as their down payment. And why I caution people against that is because a lot of times when people move into a new home, there's a lot of unexpected costs that come up.
Right.
So you don't really know how much your utilities are going to be until you're there. There, you could need a repair or a new roof, or maybe you want to do just some small projects like painting some rooms and getting new appliances, those types of things. And those things can all add up really quickly. And I would just hate to see people have a major home repair and not have their emergency savings fund in place and then really be faced with credit card debt or having to, you know, take out a home equity loan right away and put themselves in a financially vulnerable position.
Yeah. I just saw an article the other day that questioned the investment of buying a home, that perhaps people, you know, you're not going to be necessarily making any money off of it necessarily, but also that it's you know, it's a lot of money to buy that home and to upkeep that home when you might be doing better off just in an apartment. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would actually agree with that study. Traditionally, if we look over the long term, homes have only gone up about 3%, 3 to 3.5% a year, and that's pretty much in line with inflation. So a lot of times people say, oh, you know, my grandparents bought a house in the 1940s and now it's worth X number of dollars. But if we really took figure out what that would be with inflation, it would probably just be kind of keeping up with it. And so I don't consider a home an investment. I don't think you should buy a home as an investment. I think you should, you know, buy a home because it's the place you want to live long term, you want to raise a family there, whatever that might be. The other thing is, I think that the buying a home used to be the American dream, and I think that's really changing for millennials. While I see that a lot of millennials still do want to buy homes, I also see a lot of millennials value things like mobility. And so that really goes against the homeownership component. So a lot more people are relocating for different jobs across the country, or being able to, you know, take a position abroad for a year with their company, and all sorts of things like that. And so when I think about those things, I think that that kind of is in conflict with that idea of, you know, buying a home and staying put and doing those things. And I think that millennials really value mobility, and it can be a lot more affordable for them to rent for quite a few years before they buy, or you know, just always having that flexibility of being able to rent and move pretty quickly if they need to or if they want to.
That could have a lot of implications on our economy in the future, but maybe that's for another show. Melissa on Facebook writes, is individual life insurance a good investment for a millennial who already has group life insurance? I went to a financial planner for a Roth IRA and was advised to add term or whole life insurance as an individual. I am about 30 with no dependents. What do you recommend?
Great question, and I've seen this come up a lot. I do not recommend that millennials get whole life insurance. So one of the things that I'm seeing some insurance agents recommend whole life insurance for young people, and I highly advise against that because it's so much more expensive than term life insurance, and it covers such a lower amount. So I think that she's right on to start investing in that Roth IRA, and that those dollars are more valuable there than they would be in a whole life insurance policy. I think we should use insurance for insurance sake and investing for investment sake. So if your goal is to invest for retirement over the long term, great place to do that is a Roth IRA or a 401k. If you, on the other hand, need to get coverage because you have dependents, for example, then term life insurance is a great way to do that, like a 20-year term policy, a 30-year term policy. And if you have no dependents, I think that just getting your group term, your group term life insurance through your work might be a good fit for you, unless you have a ton of private student loan debt that would not be forgiven in the case of death, like if something were to happen to you, if your family was going to be stuck with that. So I think that she's very smart to kind of question the insurance agent's initial recommendations, and I would recommend talking to a fee-only independent financial planner first before making a decision on investments or insurance.
This is a special Millennials edition of On Your Money. We are talking with a guest financial planner who focuses on people in their 20s and 30s. She is Sophia Barra, nationally recognized certified financial planner in Minneapolis. Her website is genyplanning.com. If you have a question for her, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. When we come back, lots of topics that we'll discuss, but we'll also include saving for a trip and how to become a millionaire. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing quite as beautiful as cash. Some people say it's folly, but I'd rather have the lolly. With money, you can make a splash.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Our regular financial planner, Kevin McKinley, is off today. So this is a special Millennials edition of On Your Money. Our guest financial planner focuses on people in their 20s and 30s. And she will answer your questions too, Sophia Barra, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Sophia, I know you just got back from Peru. That is on my must-visit list. How was it?
Oh, it was amazing. It was so much fun.
And did you go to Machu Picchu?
Yes, of course. Yeah, it was great. And I climbed Huayna Picchu, which is the big, the kind of what everybody sees there when they think of Machu Picchu. So that was a lot of fun.
And I thank you again for joining us. I know you just got back from that trip just recently. Do you have any advice for those of us who really want to travel, and especially young people who really want to travel but don't feel like they have the resources to do it? What advice do you have about traveling so we don't break the bank?
Sure. So I love a good deal. And I think that Travelzoo has a top 20 list where they send out the top 20 financial deals each week. And I think that that's a great place to find a good travel deal. That's actually where I found the ticket to Peru for like $400-something for round trip airfare from Minneapolis to Lima.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So that's how I ended up deciding to go.
That is really quite the deal. Then, and anything else?
Yeah. And so that's where I would start. And then the other thing I would suggest is that if you pay off your credit card bills every month in full and always have, there are some great credit card rewards out there that allow you to accumulate points or miles that you can use towards travel. And I think that that's a great way to help pay for that airfare or help pay for those the hotel costs and make your trip a little bit more affordable.
Yeah, I actually redeemed some credit card points for the first time. I had so many of them, I wasn't redeeming them. I wasn't thinking about it. And what a deal that was. I did get airfare, a rental car. And,
good for you.
And I could have gotten the hotel, too, but I had a place to stay, so I didn't have to do that. But, it was I think there you just had to pay some taxes, and that was about it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Those things can really add up and really make the trip more affordable. And so I always suggest that, if people are paying those things in full every month, might as well, get a little something along the way, at least, one or two free plane tickets a year. So
let's take another call. We have Gary in Madison with us now. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, hi. I was a little confused when you were talking about renting. I'm advising my grandchildren to purchase a home rather than rent. My goodness, they would be able to deduct the interest. They'd be able to deduct the taxes. And at the end of the day, when you're renting, all you've got are rent receipts, to say nothing of the fact that they can paint it whatever color they want to and enjoy it while they live there.
Yeah, how old are your grandchildren, Gary?
They're in their late 20s.
Mm-hmm. And they're settled down now, or are they?
They finished school and they've got decent jobs,
Yeah. So as long as you're settled down and you think you're going to be somewhere for a long time, that's a different story, isn't it, Sophia?
Yeah, I would agree with that. If you do think that you're going to, be somewhere long term, it can make a lot of sense to purchase. I think that sometimes people are more concerned with getting that tax deduction than they should be. So a lot of times millennials are actually in a lower tax bracket, and that tax deduction isn't hugely beneficial to somebody in the 15% tax bracket, for example.
And plus they're going to be paying the property taxes. but in a sense, yeah, that's they're not even really benefiting from that deduction then.
Yeah, not nearly as much as somebody in the 35% tax bracket would benefit, for example.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes we place too high of a value on that tax deduction than we should.
Yeah. Well, I was pretty much settled down and I was in my later 20s when we got our first home. And it was nice because it had a fenced-in backyard and I wanted pets. And so I was able to do what I wanted.
Exactly.
But that home happened to be right here in Madison, and I'm still here a few decades later. So I guess I did
settle
down.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great.
Jeff in Bessemer, Michigan is with us. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, quick question. My daughter just finished 2 years. It's about $9,000 student loan. She can't pay it down, but I came forward and accepted their debt service on three of these loans. One's at 5%, one's at 5.2%, and one's at 6.5%. Anyway, they have to be about $9,000. And I paid it down electronically on it, electronic payment. Never missed a payment, you know, from the day one. But my question is, they won't allow me to pay down the largest one, say a $4,000 one, because they say I have to pay all three of them. In other words, $135 a month, which isn't much going on $9,000.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing it now for 3 years, and it's just making a little nudge on the principles.
Yeah, so your question is why?
Why can't I just pay down on one at a time? I mean, I'm not on any of the paperwork, but mm-hmm. they say they won't accept it on one. It has to be in. So, in other words, if I just, why are they telling me I can't, you know, can't a person just pay down on one part of the loan?
So usually there's a minimum payment on each loan, and so they do make you pay like $135, and they divide that across all three. So one thing that you can probably do is pay extra on that one that has the highest interest rate, but you'll probably have to indicate that somewhere, either on your check or sending in a letter along with your payment. So what I would do is keep those automatic payments going the way they are and then see if you can send in a couple $100 extra each month and have that just get allocated towards the 6.5% interest rate loan. And that's what I've seen some of my clients do, and they've really been able to snowball their debt a lot faster because they've been able to pay the minimums on everything and then focus on paying extra on that one with the highest interest rate first. But you're right, they usually won't let you say, hey, I just want that $135 going towards the highest interest rate loan, because the other ones have to get a minimum amount as well.
Yeah. Thank you, Jeff, for the call. Good luck. What should college grads do so their dads don't have to pay their college loans, Sophia?
Yeah, so I think it's really important to figure out to not take out more loans than you think that you'd be making your first job out of school, to kind of use that as a rule of thumb. So if you think you're going to be making, you know, $40,000 a year, your first job out of school, and that's pretty average in your industry, I really wouldn't take out more than that. I mean, if you're taking out $90,000 or $100,000 in student loans, it is going to be very difficult for you to pay those back with on a $40,000 salary. So just kind of keep that in mind as a rule of thumb. And one area that you know, for students to consider is the people that I'm seeing coming out of undergrad programs with $100,000 in student loans have often gone to private universities. So to really consider a public university or a more affordable option before taking the leap and going to that private school.
I wanted to talk to you about your conversation not too long ago with the executive of the website Eventual Millionaire, Jamie Tardy.
Yeah.
Jamie Tardy, what did you learn from her about how to become a millionaire?
So she's fabulous. We've been friends for a while, and we were able to connect at FinCon this year, which is the Financial Bloggers Conference. And she has a really interesting story because she actually started $70,000 in debt.
Wow.
And she started blogging about her own kind of get out of debt journey and how she, what she did to quickly get out of debt over just a few short years. And what she ended up doing was deciding to start interviewing millionaires and figuring out, like, hey, how did you do it? And so one of the things that we spent a lot of time talking about was aligning your money with your values. your spending with your values. So figuring out those things that really bring you joy in life and provide great value, and allocating more money towards those things, and figuring out those areas that don't provide as much value and trimming the costs and cutting back in those areas. And then another thing that I noticed is that a lot of the people that she interviews are business owners. So these are people that really took the leap. These are entrepreneurs who are able to become millionaires by creating a great business idea, selling a certain product, selling services, those types of things that were able to really launch their business and create wealth over the long term, or sometimes pretty quickly.
So that means that I can trim costs when it comes to like new furniture and cleaning supplies, and spend more when it comes to traveling.
Well, that's what I do.
Good, we're together on that one. Steve in Boulder Junction is with us. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I just wanted to remind people that their reward points on credit cards, on some cards, maybe all cards, expire after a certain amount of time. So you want to make sure you take a look at your statements and make sure you don't lose any. I almost lost about $2,000 worth of them this winter because they were about to expire, so I went and blew the whole thing on a trip. But if I wouldn't have looked at my statements, I would have lost a lot of points.
Yeah, good advice, Steve. I'm lucky that mine did not expire, or they did and I didn't notice. I still had plenty of them because I hadn't used them. So that's right, Sophia? Rewards points can't expire?
That's a great point. Yeah, some do, some don't. Mm-hmm. So it's important to check, like you said, your credit card statement or with the airline as well. So a lot of times people sign up for a bunch of frequent flyer programs and then don't look at those for years. Those are the things that I notice that do expire, are those frequent flyer awards. So if you're not flying with a certain airline consistently, then, you know, you might end up losing some airline miles. So just to kind of be aware of the airline miles as well as the credit card points and making sure that, you know, if you are getting them, that you're using them.
Well, we're almost out of time. Do you have any last-minute quick financial advice for our millennial listeners today?
Sure. I think it goes back to a lot of what we touched on in the beginning. So stay out or get out of credit card debt. Build emergency savings. That's about 3 to 6 months of your net pay in terms of your income. But start with $500 or $1,000. That's going to go a long way. Sign up for your 401k and contribute enough to at least get your company match. So let's say your company will contribute the first 5% that will match the first 5% that you contribute. Make sure you're doing at least 5% so that you get your full company match.
All right, good. We'll leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Joy. You have a great day.
You too. Sophia Berra is a nationally recognized certified financial planner based in Minneapolis. Her focus is on financial education and financial planning for people in their 20s and 30s. Her website is genyplanning.com. Well, thanks very much to Bill Martins and to Cynthia Schuster for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will be back with us next week for another edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.